This is a special KMOX news presentation.
Tragedies unfold in St. Louis every day, lives ripped apart in seconds by a bullet. Even if you don't suffer the trauma and grief firsthand, you can't escape the aftermath. In this hour, KMOX News has a special report, Open Wounds, the Impact of Gun Violence in St. Louis.
You look over your shoulder, you watch what you're doing. Oh, yeah.
But coming to the city, you know, kind of watch the neighborhoods we go. Got the grandbaby with us, my daughter with us, even, you know, my child, I'm not going to put in danger.
Half the times I'm sitting out there, I hear gunshots in, like, my neighborhood. And it's in Tower Grove East, it's a pretty big problem. I was born in the city, you know, that's where I was raised. So it's just kind of like, to me, it sucks to say, but I'm used to it.
I moved here from Walnut Park to get away from the gun violence. And when I got over here to the south side, it's just as bad, if not worse.
About 4 years ago on Father's Day, I was robbed gunpoint. They still haven't left me yet.
When you hear people say, well, I won't come into the city because of violence, do you think that's ridiculous or do you understand it?
I understand it.
Carjackings, drive-bys, armed robberies, rolling gun battles. I'm Megan Lynch. Some people are numb to it, others living with apprehension and fear. In the most brutal blocks of the city, residents like Charles Mayo say they go to more wakes than weddings, more grave sites than graduations.
Either you get shot at or you get shot. Once you heal, if you don't die, either it's going to turn you into one thing. You're going to either be a shooter or victim.
Mayo has survived a life in a part of the city that in 2017 saw more than 150 shootings and nearly two dozen killings.
If you came to me at 17 and told me some cute stuff about being safe with my gun, I'm going to blow you off and I'm going to keep my gun because he's going to blow me away.
This is Carol Daniel. Children growing up in these violent neighborhoods are traumatized by what they see and hear. And those who try to educate them must also handle the emotional baggage they bring to school. Stephanie Merklin is a special education teacher at Farragut Elementary School in St. Louis Public Schools. She says learning must at times take a back seat.
What matters is that they understand that they're loved and taken care of. Once they know that, then they can learn what 2 plus 2 is.
Some of those who treat the physical damage to tissue and organs when bullets rip through bodies also live in the very city where the violence occurs.
Nowadays, I'm afraid to walk out and empty my trash at night in one of the most stable neighborhoods in the city.
Helen Sancool is Director of Emergency Room Nurses at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. She has 3 decades of ER experience. Her nurses may see 6 or 7 gunshot wounds in a weekend, and she knows many think they're immune to what they see.
And to an extent, we are, compared to maybe a nurse that works on a pediatric unit or a nurse that works on a medical floor where they don't see the daily violence-related issues that come into the emergency department.
In fact, some studies show as many as 33% of emergency department nurses have screened positive for symptoms of PTSD.
People can say, I'm tough, I can take it. There's a breaking point for everybody.
Carol Daniel, News Radio 1120 KMOX.
You may hear gunfire every night, or you may just hear about the aftermath in the news. For some, they live every day with deep personal grief.
I cry every day. I cry every day because I see her.
Erica Jones sees Whitney, the daughter she lost, in the face of her grandson, Jakeem, a child who witnessed his mother cut down by a spray of bullets from a pickup truck.
Jakeem has the memory of, Nana, my mama fell against a car and she gonna wake up in the morning when the sun come up.
In August 2015, Erica was called to that scene in the Walnut Park West neighborhood where her daughter had gone to visit a friend. She recalls a deep, sick feeling when she arrived.
I knew. I didn't want to think my daughter was gone, but I knew she was gone. I felt it.
Whitney had just moved into a new apartment, bought her own car, and was working on her nursing degree. A beautiful young woman planning a future. Gone. Erica is now left to raise her grandson.
A little boy wants his mother. I'm his Nana. I'm not his mother.
She says she's been blessed by an employer who has provided counseling for her entire family. But how does anyone come to grips with what happened?
What did our children do? Like, what did they do for somebody to come down the street with a gun and decide to shoot? We have people out here taking people's lives just on a whim.
Whitney's murder was one of nearly 190 in the city that year. It was the shooting of a Cardinals fan a month later that became the lead story for weeks.
Still to this day, he'll say, where did you park, Mom? Why did I park there? Why did this happen to me?
Candace Santa expresses her overwhelming guilt. Her family had been celebrating her birthday at a Cardinals game in downtown St. Louis. Her son Chris and his girlfriend Lisa had parked near the old cathedral.
When you're at the Cardinals game, you just don't think that you're in those bad areas.
But that night, a man got out of his car and chased Santa down with a gun.
I heard like a whistle. And that was the first bullet going by.
The second bullet tore through his body. As he lay helpless, the shooter held them both at gunpoint, going through Chris's pockets and taking Lisa's belongings. It was weeks into his recovery, when he lay helpless in bed with his mom trying to help, that the horrifying reality of his future hit.
She couldn't pick me up, and her and I just broke down and started crying. I kept asking her why.
2 years later, it's still this hard to talk about.
Paralyzed from the waist down, Chris sits in a power-assisted wheelchair in his kitchen. The shooting took his mobility, his financial security, his independence, and on some days, his dignity.
It's hell. Yeah. It's hell on earth.
While Candace still has her son, they've lost their peace.
He's afraid to go out. He's scared that something is going to happen to him. I work downtown, and I get out of my car, and I park as close as I can to the door. I look around. We don't go to things downtown because we're so afraid.
And while his attacker, Kilwa Jones, apologized at his sentencing, the Santas haven't come to forgiveness.
Do I wish him harm? Yeah, I wish he was paralyzed.
A decade ago, a deadly shooting rampage at Kirkwood City Hall shattered the peace of that community as well as the region.
And he also started shouting something, and then he proceeded to pull a large silver revolver, you know, like I think out from under his coat, pointed at the officer and fired at him.
He shot three other people who were attending the council meeting. They are also deceased.
Amazing grace.
And truly tonight, may God bless Kirkwood.
I'm Michael Calhoun. Perhaps it was the need to be around each other or the desire for some sort of explanation, but what seemed to be more than a
thing. The canvas of our community has been ripped. The fabric of our way of life torn by violence.
The people in those council chambers who had to witness that violence still ask why.
And I think about the people that were murdered that evening, that died that evening. And I think about the things that they wanted to say to people that they didn't get a chance to say, which is heartbreaking.
Kirkwood City Attorney John Hessel, one of the survivors of the slaughter that night.
And it's impossible to describe how horrific it is.
Charles Cookie Thornton stormed into the council chambers after shooting an officer outside. As Thornton turned his sights on him, Hessel instinctively threw chairs and managed to escape.
You'll always question, how did I survive? Why did I survive? What am I supposed to do? Why was I spared? What plan does God have for me? That goes on day in and day out. Really does. It has never gone away from me.
Thornton fired his weapons for more than a minute until he was taken down by two officers. Five people died that night. The mayor died from his injuries 7 months later.
We could be gone in an instant. I never lose sight of the fact that none of us are guaranteed anything, and life is so very, very short, so very, very fragile that you need to cherish every second of it.
Tim Griffin, the current mayor of Kirkwood, was also in council chambers that day and spoke with KMOX's Brett Bloom.
I mean, the meeting started just a normal meeting. A few people in the crowd. We had a public hearing. Start with the, you know, Pledge of Allegiance. Every standing for the Pledge of Allegiance. Sit down, get ready to start the public hearing, and then Cookie walked in. Police officer Ballman was regularly there, and at that point he was sitting. Here's the council dais, the back door. He used to sit right over here on this side, and it was odd because Cookie normally just came in the center of the room, and he didn't do that night. It was I do remember he came in the back, and instead of coming down the center, he walked this way, and that was odd. But and then he had the sandwich board signs, which he often often had, and then he was stopped by Officer Ballman and then pulled his guns out and started shooting.
Was he able to hide the weapons in the sandwich board? Is that what's
yep.
going on?
Yep, yep.
And he had already shot a police officer outside.
What's interesting about that is, the counsel, the windows are right here. Even Tom Ballman was right by the windows. And the only thing people like in the police station around heard it. We didn't hear it in the council chambers, probably because everyone was reciting the Pledge of Allegiance at the time. So that sound was muffled. No one, there was absolutely no sound of that. So that's when he came, after that is when he came in.
That's just pure chance. I mean, you guys probably would have heard the shots if not for that.
Oh, absolutely. People inside the police station heard stuff and people around it. It just, it was just pure chance that it happened while the room was reciting the Pledge of Allegiance. Mm. Yeah.
So Cookie starts shooting. What happens at that point?
Well, at that point, it's interesting because, I knew Cookie. I mean, we were friends. And so even all the years through his, he would come to the council and do his complaints and all that. I mean, and I wasn't the only one. We knew him, so we just, it was like, come on, all right, Cookie, come on. The first thought when those guns came out, my first thought was, oh, Cookie, yeah, you've gone too far. Thinking it was just a joke. I'm thinking, this is not a good joke. I mean, this is all within a split second. Cookie, you've gone too far, and this could be trouble for you. Well, and then immediately he shot Officer Ballman, and we realized, This wasn't a joke.
When open wounds, the impact of gun violence in St. Louis continues, Carol Daniel shares insights from people on the front lines of gun trauma.
This is a special KMOX news presentation.
Welcome back. I'm Megan Lynch. Moments ago, you heard how gun violence has forever changed the lives of victims and their families. As we continue our report on open wounds, the impact of gun violence in St. Louis, Carol Daniel takes you inside SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital to see how nurses handle the trauma of treating so many victims.
Helen Sancool is Director of Emergency Room Nurses at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. It's not unusual for 6 or 7 gunshot victims to be brought into the Level 1 Trauma Center each weekend. Too many, she says, have been there before, and she has seen it before, like the man who came running into St. Mary's Hospital in East St. Louis years ago.
He ran to the trauma room. He knew where the trauma room was because he had been shot 3 times before, so that's very sad. A lot of these kids, they're not shot just once or 2 times, but they're shot, on multiple occasions.
Sancool says having support from family and hospital leadership is key to nurses handling the trauma they see.
People can say, I'm tough, I can take it. There's a breaking point for everybody.
Like that day in 1980 when a teenager carried a 4-year-old boy into her emergency room. The teen survived, the 4-year-old did not.
I stood in that room and I bawled like a baby. And to the day I die, I will not forget this kid and the look on his face when they put him in my arms.
She says they're also mindful that the gunshot they must treat may not be the only issue.
We get some people in that are under the influence of drugs and alcohol, and sometimes you can't be reasonable. So that's when you have to have protective services available and different things like that.
And there are concerns when there are multiple shootings.
You have large crowds that will, wind up, on Vista Avenue, or if it's at Barnes, wound up on Kings Highway.
And keeping the emergency room open for other patients requires a plan in place to keep everyone safe. Sancool says when heart attack or stroke victims come into the ER, it is standard for nurses to talk to them about lifestyle changes and healing. But she says they don't talk to gunshot victims at all.
Especially if it's gang-related, or if it's, something where it was retaliation or whatever, we're afraid to talk about it.
She'd like to see someone say something to them before they're released in order to interrupt the cycle of violence.
That we actually say the word, we need to talk about you being shot. And I'm not the police. I don't want any details. I'm not going to use this against you, but I don't want to see you back in here.
They aren't allowed to play outside. They frequently hear gunshots or have seen bleeding victims or have themselves been physically wounded. Then these, the youngest victims, go to school with all that emotional baggage.
We see children who are a lot of times very volatile, and the smallest things set them off.
The parents don't believe that their child is safe anywhere.
On a sunny, cold day in St. Louis, I sat down with a principal and five teachers at Farragut Elementary School in St. Louis Public Schools.
Anita Crawford, first grade teacher. Yolanda Fordson, ICA.
All 150 students receive free or reduced lunch, and far too many are intimately aware of gun violence and the host of other issues that often come along with it.
We have a preschooler whose parent picked them up from school and took them home, and someone shot and killed a parent with him in the car. So he's struggling a lot.
When Patricia Cox became principal 9 years ago, she remembers parents telling her they didn't feel their child was safe at her school. But what she learned was,
the parents don't believe that their child is safe anywhere.
She realized she had to tell them
that if you would let us take care of them, I promise you don't have to teach them to fight. You don't have to teach them, soon as someone touches them, I promise you we will take care of it.
That survival attitude is prevalent among boys, including a fifth grader who would leave his classroom to go defend his little brother in the first grade. Cox discovered his mother told him to do that, and she found out why. They were homeless.
And she swore him to secrecy, so we didn't know that they were leaving here, and they were getting on two buses and going to Jennings alone.
Farragut is a trauma-informed school and part of the program called Shut It Down, designed to reduce suspensions. It starts with one simple understanding.
Because for whatever reason, they don't have community outside Farragut. So we have to create community for them. What does it look like? What does it sound like? What does it mean to be a partner for someone? What does it mean to care about someone?
Bob LaPlante is a family community specialist at Farragut.
We're wondering, like, you know, in the past, it used to be, what is wrong with this child? But over the years, we've been getting trained about the effects of trauma. So now, instead of saying what's wrong with the child, we say what happened.
They know that gun violence and other turmoil can go hand in hand. LaToya Baker is an in-school success teacher. Her room is filled with snacks for students who come hungry or who need what's called a brain break from their class.
Are they opening up to you?
Yes.
What do they tell you?
I have heard, I know someone have seen this dad get shot. I have... Kids have been in the car, high-speed chases. They tell me a lot.
The trauma students experience at home can show up in disruptive behavior in the class. Bob LaPlante says his job includes home visits and de-escalating parents who often think teachers are picking on their kids.
Some of them are to a place where they're just so angry, so upset. No matter what we've done, they've left. But the ones that do listen, it's like, oh, it's like the whole world off their shoulder.
Carol Daniel, News Radio 1120 KMOX.
How does news of dozens of homicides a year and hundreds of shootings impact you?
I think people are so afraid now, and that it's become normal for them to hear about a
de-escalating parents who often think teachers are picking on their kids.
Some of them are to a place where they're just so angry, so upset. No matter what we've done, they've left. But the ones that do listen, it's like, oh, it's like the whole world off their shoulder.
Carol Daniel, News Radio 1120 KMOX.
How does news of dozens of homicides a year and hundreds of shootings impact you?
I think people are so afraid now, and that it's become normal for them to hear about someone being killed.
Erica Jones lost her daughter in a drive-by shooting 2 years ago in a part of St. Louis City notorious for bloodshed. This hour on KMOX, you've heard about the devastating human cost, the grief of loss, the struggle for survivors, and the trauma for bystanders. Yet a case can be made that anyone who lives in this region pays a deep price. More now as we conclude Open Wounds, the impact of gun violence in St. Louis. Neighborhoods in the urban core are increasingly isolated by violence.
A reputation of a certain block within a certain neighborhood can cast a really long shadow.
Dean Obermark is a research associate with the Urban Institute in Washington, D.C. He grew up in the St. Louis suburbs.
Are these fears about going to certain neighborhoods or even crossing the Del Mar divide unrealistic? I would definitely say so.
Before moving to D.C., Obermark was a researcher with the St. Louis Metropolitan Police Department. He points out most of the day-to-day high levels of violence are between a small number of parties on a small number of blocks. Regardless, we hear the echoes of gunfire for miles.
It can really sort of hang in the way as this specter that confronts any, you know, possible progress or any planning.
The Urban Institute has measured the economic impact.
We know that gun violence in neighborhoods reduces business growth, reduces home appreciation. We know that it can hurt credit scores.
Gun violence impacts the tax base.
There's no question that high levels of violent crime, gun violence in particular, mean that people move out of the city who otherwise might stay. People don't move into the city who otherwise might.
Richard Rosenfeld is founder's professor of criminology and criminal justice at the University of Missouri, St. Louis.
And as the central city suffers, the region can't grow. People identify regions with their central cities.
One possible example of stifled growth is our light rail system.
It's very likely we would have more spurs, more lines on that system now, were it not for the fact of fears and perceptions of high levels of violence.
There's a more immediate price tag we all pay.
Typically, people who are victims of gun violence in St. Louis are poor, and so the taxpayer ends up picking up the tab for hospitalization.
For victims with financial means, there are lost wages, in some cases permanent disability. We're also paying more to maintain some sense of safety.
Our security costs higher than they would be if we had a lower crime rate? The answer is, of course, they're higher.
Where you have an uptick in violence, where you have homicide rates that go up, you have guns on the street, you have people like us who are installing metal detectors and devices to find those guns so that those guns can't get into events.
Michael Hackett, president and CEO of Hackett Security in St. Louis. Devices only seen in courthouses and airports years ago are now in the lobbies of nightclubs, movie theaters, and more recently in emergency rooms and schools.
Somewhere, somebody is paying for that. Those burdens are coming out of the general funds that those schools are relying on.
St. Louis is paying a steep financial price. Gun violence has cost so many their peace of mind. At this point, can you afford to dismiss the fears?
You do think about it, but then you brush it aside like it's never going to happen to me. That only happens to other people.
It happened to John Hessel. He escaped gunman Cookie Thornton in the Kirkwood City Council chambers a decade ago as six other people, his friends, neighbors, and colleagues, were slaughtered.
I keep asking myself, why? What is causing us in our society to have people decide that they just want to take other people's lives?
When we return, Carol Daniel has a firsthand look at what officers face on the streets.
This is a special KMOX news presentation.
This is Carol Daniel. How do police officers handle the day-to-day stress of going from a fight to a car accident to a domestic violence call and then to a murder or stabbing? The head of the Homicide Division in the St. Louis Metropolitan Police Department is Lieutenant John Green. He has always wanted to be a police officer. He says he had an uncle who retired as a captain and another uncle who was a narcotics detective. An only child, Green grew up in St. Louis.
Well, growing up in the inner city and in bad parts of towns, you see different things. I expect, I get a call for disturbance. I see that, fights. Been in a few fights, seen a couple of fights, a few fights, broke up a couple of fights. So I'm used to that. It's some things that you're not used to that you don't see as a civilian is children, things being done to children. Now, I was totally oblivious to that because, I'm a teenage kid. I'm not seeing that stuff. And then you really see when you get some of these calls involving children, you see the families and you see there's something going on and it comes out that the child's being abused or sexually abused or doesn't have anything to eat. you know, had don't go to school, you know, things like that. That like, wow, why would you, you know, how you do that to a little kid? You know, you don't see that every day. Now, if it's you, grown woman, you know, she didn't have nothing to eat for 2 days. Okay, take her to shelter. Let's go get her something to eat. Child different. That child can't fend for themselves, or they can't support themselves. They need help. So it was really hard. Yes, I still see it. But I deal with dead children now, children that have been killed or shot. And that's really hard to deal with, too, sometimes.
So how does he cope?
For me personally, I was able to manage my stress in a good way, either exercise or have a hobby or something, talking out with my family. You know, the things don't get to me, but, you know, every now and then I'll mention something to my wife, you know. But if you ask her, she doesn't even know what I, you know. She knows she's on TV and she'll ask, and I don't want to talk about it or whatever. But the department has other ways. We have a officer wellness program for officers that can go to get help if they need it. Because a lot of people don't realize we're not factory made.
Not robots.
You know, we're not robots. We're out, just like you from the community. And we see more. You don't see it, but we have to endure it. So people need to understand, you know, that's, you know, we're just like you. And there's no difference. We have some training, but it doesn't prepare us for what you see out in the street. So, I mean, like I just said, we got a program here to help officers. They had a love on a leash come through. And that was kind of breaking the ice, you know. When they came through the office, everybody got to play with dogs. It relieved a little stress. We get back to work, but every little helps.
Do you shield your wife, it sounds like? Or do you just not want to bring it home?
No, I just don't want to bring it home. You know, she watches TV, you know. First 48, you look at it, she's watching now. I don't want to watch that. I'm doing it every day.
Lieutenant Green says he has never felt he needed to leave the profession due to the stress, saying he goes in every day thinking of how he can help. It was the shooting in Walnut Park that left 7-year-old Denaya Irving without her parents and an uncle that truly affected Green.
Yes, we were at the scene. She was gone. She had been rushed to the hospital. Her little sister was there, had blood on her, and there was just people on the street that were taking care of her, holding her.
So her mother's dead.
Father's dead. And uncle's dead.
Mm-hmm. An arrest has been made in the case, and Green has been able to see Denaya. It is one of the very few times he has shed tears.
It was at a church. Pastor Factions, I guess, adopted the family, and I think grandmama was a member of his church, and they wanted to give her something, and he wanted me to be there. Wow. And so he invited me to it. And, you know, as kids involved, you're like, I'll go, you know, see the little girl and see how she's doing, you know, wish her well. And, you know, you see the little kid walking, you know, on a little walker. It's not supposed to be like that, you know, and just because of somebody's stupid decision. You know, now the kid lost mom, daddy, and uncle, and now she's lost part of her brain. You know, that's kind of hard to deal with. So it's, you know, you think in your head, you replay it back in your head, how could this have been avoided? You know, or what could they have done to avoid this? You know, you got your kids in the car, you know, maybe not go over there that day, you know, maybe just say, you know, whatever happened between.
Do we know the background? I mean, do we know the motive of that?
I do, but I'm not going to talk about it. No, I can't say. It was personal because it was a child. And another reason that I broke down, you know, a child is supposed to be full of play, laugh, running, jumping. She couldn't do that. And she had, you know, a walker. She was walking down the church aisle. It took a long time for her to turn, a long time for her to answer questions. She was getting her motor skills, but they were, you know, gone.
Green, who is African-American, says he doesn't feel any pressure in his career based on that. He does say the truth is most suspects in the city of St. Louis are black, and most victims are as well. He understands the role other socioeconomic factors play, but says more men are needed in the home and in stable relationships. That, he says, will help lead to better decision-making and a change in crime patterns.
Still ahead, a researcher looks at the economic impact of gun violence on the St. Louis region.
This is a special KMOX news presentation.
I'm Megan Lynch. As you've heard this hour, gun violence does impact communities in very measurable ways. The Urban Institute in Washington, D.C. found that business owners in neighborhoods with high rates of gun violence were forced to take on the cost of enhanced security measures. Those businesses also found their bottom line suffered because local residents don't feel comfortable shopping after dark. Residents of those communities also say gun violence hurts their housing prices because existing community members relocate and prospective new residents avoid certain neighborhoods. I spoke with Dean Obermark, research associate with the Urban Institute. Obermark happens to be a St. Louis native who previously worked for the St. Louis Metropolitan Police Department as an internal researcher. We talked about his impression of St. Louis now that he's spent some time researching other areas of the United States.
Something that always sticks out with St. Louis, and really I've only seen in Pittsburgh a similar level, is the level of political fragmentation. So the city and county municipal structure, where you have, you know, 90 or so independent municipalities in the county of St. Louis, there is something that resembles that in Pittsburgh. But when you have a problem like violence or gun violence that clearly really afflicts the region and doesn't in any way respect certain political boundaries, I think that fragmentation can really work against you in terms of collaboration and forming a cohesive and coherent approach. So which we see across a lot of other municipal issues too, right? It's in addressing anything, it's hard to collaborate across those political boundaries. And that's something that certainly seems like a unique challenge for St. Louis.
Well, then, are there unrealistic fears about gun violence in neighborhoods that don't necessarily have to be worried about high gun violence rates? You know, are we that fractured that there's these, you know, invisible lines between these communities?
Yeah, I mean, speaking first from personal experience, I certainly felt that growing up. You know, I grew up in a fairly affluent patch of the suburbs, and you know, me and my family seemed as if like rarely made trips into the city. It was really until, you know, I was 18 or 19 and going to college and living independently that I started exploring the city myself. So through a long, long history of policies and private decisions, there's this distance that's definitely created between the city proper and the surrounding suburbs. But then, of course, even within the city itself, there's the North and South Del Mar divide, which isn't unique to St. Louis, right? We see high levels of segregation in many other cities. But it's definitely striking, and I think it's, you know, a powerful symbol that seems to weigh on everyone in the region. And getting back to the initial question about, are these fears about going to certain neighborhoods or even crossing the Del Mar divide unrealistic? I would definitely say so. We know two things about violence fairly well at this point. We know that's heavily concentrated among certain people in certain places. So in a region like St. Louis, you have a very, very, very small percentage of the population that's participating in violence. And the places where that occurs, although random acts tend to get a lot of news coverage, but the day-to-day still very high levels of violence occur between a small number of parties, and really on, you know, a small number of blocks, even sort of at the spatial level, it really is concentrated in what we call microgeography. So things like blocks or street segments that really over time, you know, over 10, 15 years can experience terribly high levels of violence. So even within a neighborhood itself, violence can really be a block-to-block phenomenon. But I would say, yeah, a reputation of a certain block within a certain neighborhood can cast a really long shadow, right? And just being adjacent to a neighborhood or even to a sub-neighborhood area with high levels of violence seems to bring down or affect people's willingness to go to those places.
Could we say, too, as well, that if there is a block or a neighborhood that does have high incidence of gun violence, does that tend to then isolate that neighborhood or district from the surrounding communities?
I think there is, sort of alienation that occurs, and that's definitely what we're picking up and when we look at sort of business pattern data, is that although we're looking at these sort of downstream effects like job creation, business openings, I think at the more like individual level, behavioral level, that's a reflection of that place becoming alienated or becoming a place where people no longer want to go. I think for the residents themselves, right, that's really hurtful because they're becoming increasingly isolated from economic opportunities, which were probably already somewhat hard to come by because the neighborhood itself was, you know, neighborhoods that tend to experience gun violence have sort of a lower socioeconomic starting status. So it's not like the opportunities were plentiful beforehand. And then when we see these surges of gun violence, we see places that are in a tough spot or maybe sort of like a middling spot for things to get worse there. So
I guess to wrap us up, one of my last questions for you would be, what maybe are your impressions of what's being ignored or forgotten or overlooked in these discussions of the impact of gun violence?
I think oftentimes we overlook the communities themselves. They're directly affected. So these communities are already, you know, disempowered in different ways. They've a lot of times in an area like St. Louis experienced decades or generations of disinvestment, both on the private side, so people, you know, moving out of a neighborhood, white flight, but also on the public side where policies have been deliberately sort of set to work against them. So they've been systematically disempowered in different ways. And I think even in our discussions of gun violence, we can kind of ignore them. And as much as I'm interested in the economic impacts and how gun violence can affect business growth in the neighborhood, I think we need to always keep it in the forefront that these are, human beings that are exactly, or if not exactly, much like ourselves, and that they're experiencing trauma every day. And that when we're thinking about how we need to treat gun violence, when we're thinking about policy solutions or programs to address gun violence, we need to keep their experience in the forefront as well. So they're directly experiencing it. They know what it's like to live in a neighborhood that has high levels of gun violence. They know sometimes what it's like to be a victim of gun violence. So to leave them out of a conversation about the effects, small and large, of gun violence, I think is a huge mistake. And then from a research side, to leave their perspectives out of our understanding of gun violence as sort of a phenomenon, as well as to leave their understanding of gun violence out of our conversations about programs or policies to address gun violence, it's not only wrong because we're further ignoring the disempowered, but just from a practical perspective, they understand gun violence in ways that I, as a researcher in an office in Washington, D.C., never will.
That's Dean Obermark, research associate with the Urban Institute. I'm Megan Lynch. For more information on our series, Open Wounds, the Impact of Gun Violence in St. Louis, go to KMOX.com.